That's Ferndale, Michigan's jazz double bassist Ron Carter and Sir Roland Hanna on the keys, introducing Blues in the Closet, composed and recorded by the legendary bassist Oscar Pettiford. And that's from Carter's 2002 album, Stardust, Lenny White on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It is Thursday, September the 25th, and Attorney General Eric Holder is supposed to be announcing his resignation today from the Obama administration. Those are the reports. We don't know yet. And in Ferguson, Missouri, Police Chief Tom Jackson has issued a video apology to the family of Michael Brown, saying that it was very sad that the body was left too long in the street after he was fatally shot by the police officer. Well, the federal trial to determine whether Detroit's bankruptcy exit plan is fair and feasible resumed this week after a one-week pause to allow Financial Guarantee Insurance Company, the largest creditor, to meet with the city and mediators on a possible settlement deal. But Judge Stephen Rhodes began hearing testimony from angry Detroiters vehemently opposed to the emergency manager, Kevin Orr, and his draconian and arbitrary measures. Their objections, especially over extreme economic hardship, foreclosures, and mass water shutoffs under Orr, are echoing beyond the courtroom. Detroiters want him gone by tomorrow when his 18-month term ends. Abayomi Azikiwe, our correspondent on Detroit's bankruptcy, provides an update of what's going on in this multi-pronged battle. Thanks, Abayomi, for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us what's going on with this this throng of angry people in the courtroom telling Judge Rhodes what he needed to hear from the outset.
This was a evidentiary hearing that started on Monday. It concluded on Tuesday, and the trial has been adjourned until Monday, but the testimony was riveting from victims of the massive water shutoffs that were initiated back in March under the emergency manager, Kevin Orr. There was a class action lawsuit as the latest intervention in this whole crisis. That was filed in July, right after the objections hearing that took place, where the water issue was actually brought in as testimony during the objections hearing. What is going on now is that the lawyers for the plaintiffs, i.e. those who are the victims of the water shutoffs, as well as four community organizations based in Detroit, that they get a six-month halt to the water shutoffs, and that a real affordability plan and real safeguards are put in place to prevent this type of massive termination of water services throughout the city of Detroit. Well, they have uncovered documents to indicate that some 19,000 households were terminated just over the last 7 months. It still remains that at least 5,000 do not have water services even today. People who have children, people who have chronic illnesses, senior citizens, people with disabilities have been struck by water shutoffs. This also comes in conjunction with the recently floated proposal for a Great Lakes Regional Water Authority, which most people in the city of Detroit are against. There was a city council hearing last week in which the majority of the people spoke out against it, with the exception of the supporters of Mike Duggan, the mayor, the corporate-imposed mayor from Livonia, who's now over Detroit, theoretically. So this is a major issue in this decision. The judge says he will announce his decision on Monday, so people are anticipating exactly what is going to be the outcome of the water issue. And I'll pause here, but we can talk about the FGIC situation later.
I was just going to ask about that. In fact, the trial had gone through a one-week delay so that the Financial Guarantee Insurance Company could have more time to prepare its case after Cincora worked out a sweet deal with the city and left the FGIC as the lone big money creditor with more than $1 billion owed. What has come of that one-week delay as far as FGIC is concerned?
Apparently, they're planning a new strategy. Now they want to attack the appraisals of the Detroit Institute of Arts collections. Within the context of the grand bargain, they placed a value on the Detroit Institute of Arts works as some $815 million. Many people within our community and even lay people felt that was a gross undervaluation of the artwork. Now FGIC has developed their own experts, and they're saying that the artwork is worth 10 times that much. And as a result, they should either sell some of the art and turn the money over to the FGIC or come up with some more cash at any rate for their corporation. They stand to lose approximately $1 billion if this plan of adjustment is forced through and if Judge Rhodes is able to rubber stamp it. So they're really fighting for an enormous amount of money. And they're saying that the Detroit Institute of Arts is up for grabs, that the art there could be auctioned off in order to pay these vulture insurance firms that actually guaranteed a lot of the bad loans and bond issues that has ensnarled the city of Detroit in so much financial ruin. So they're really not fighting on any principle basis. They're really fighting just for more money for their own owners and stockholders.
Well, with Cincora getting away with a nice fat deal and with the FGIC waiting in the wings to add it, for its turn to score a nice fat deal, it seems as if there might be a kind of buyer's remorse on the part of the city pension funds. They seem to be saying, at least I'm reading stories where the pension fund negotiators were saying, look, we bargained in good faith with the city, and we accepted a cut, and our people are going to be accepting a cut, and we did this in the interest of helping the city. So are they now having second thoughts about do they feel like they were had, or do they feel that they should have a change of heart?
I believe most of the pensioners themselves believe they've been had. But the trustees and the leadership of these entities, including AFSCME, they agreed to accept these cuts. This is the best that they could do out of the entire process. But yes, most people feel as if they've been robbed, and they're going to be robbed even further if this plan is put into place, because still the city of Detroit is going to be stuck with at least $7 billion in debt. And that's not going to be sustainable, considering the fact that it's anticipated that next year there could be over 100,000 potential tax foreclosures in the city of Detroit, which would imperil the tax revenue even further. So how is Detroit going to pay back this money that still is going to be left for them to address? So this is really remains to be seen whether or not this plan is going to be approved and whether or not there's going to be any real improvement of the living conditions of people here in the city of Detroit, which the wealthy don't care anything about, but the people are very much involved in contemplating what is the outcome of all of this going to mean for civil servants, for homeowners, for people who are being forced out of their neighborhoods, and for those who have to live and work in the city.
Well, Warren Buffett was recently in your fair city speaking to an investor group there, and he declared that the city will be better off and stronger still after bankruptcy. How is that resonating in the city of Detroit?
I don't think that many people even paid that much attention to him. Not the masses. Maybe the wealthy interests may have paid some attention. But it's important to note that Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway investment company withdrew all of their holdings in municipal bond markets 2 years ago. So they don't have faith themselves in municipal finance. And it's a $3.7 trillion industry. And there's a lot of problems associated with it, particularly if you can take into consideration the legacy costs, the pension obligations, healthcare obligations, the problems associated with funding public transportation and education. Home foreclosures are still a serious problem. So I don't think that many people pay that much attention to Mr. Buffett because you have to put your money where your mouth is. And obviously, he doesn't have that much faith in the municipal market as of the last several years.
Well, he wasn't talking to the regular people of Detroit. He was talking to the people who are watching.
Of course.
The reimagined Detroit coming along just fine.
Yeah.
The corporate deals that are being struck and the idea that Detroit is getting ready to be a new city with new people and a new vision. And the other people will just have to clear out. But once that's done, it's going to be really, really good.
Well, yeah, this is the vision of the 1% that you can rebuild the city through entertainment districts and through speculative financial deals. The problem is we've heard all this before, and it hasn't worked. I think I mentioned before on this program that during the 1990s, they had a proposal to build two new stadiums, which was done by the end of the decade, a new stadium for the Detroit Tigers and one for the Detroit Lions. And they said this would be the genesis of the revitalization of the city. And then at the very end of the decade, they opened three casino hotels. And they said that, of course, would seal the future stability and viability of the city of Detroit. And we know that the conditions have worsened tremendously over the last 15 years. And even this much championed casino tax revenue now is still tied up through Cincor in the bankruptcy proceedings, because it's still the conflict between Bank of America and Cincor over the insurance payments and other deals involving these interest rate swaps are still not settled. There has to be some additional negotiations to take place. And most of the casinos now are not doing well, not just in Detroit, but Atlantic City. All of them have closed except two. So when you have a situation where people's incomes are declining, they don't have that type of disposable income to go and visit casinos to gamble or to eat or whatever people do at the casinos. So we've heard all this before, and even in today's corporate media, they had an illustration, this utopian vision of this 45-block entertainment district that's going to be built in the Cass Corridor and Brush Park area. They're breaking ground on the new hockey arena today downtown. However, beyond the construction, what type of real jobs are going to be created in these institutions, particularly the sports arenas? They're seasonal, and the majority of the people who work there are temporary employees who make low wages. So the owners will make money, and it will be fun, you know, for the fans to come in and, you know, enjoy the games. But in terms of people who live there and who live in the city, I don't see how they're really going to benefit substantially, particularly in the long term.
Well, let's get to the big matter here. The city wants emergency manager Kevin Orr gone. He has been appointed. He was appointed under a state statute that allows him to run affairs for 18 months, and that ends tomorrow. The city council supposedly is determining whether In fact, they can make him gone, and that would require about two-thirds of the nine-member council to vote that way. How is that shaping up?
Well, they've had closed sessions all of this week over that issue. From what I understand, there was a meeting that took place yesterday for 4 hours, which Duggan was involved in, and they would not say how things were shaping up. Yes, tomorrow is supposed to be his deadline. There's some discussion about keeping him on as a representative, legal representative, in the bankruptcy process. It was quite interesting. There was an article that was published today in the Detroit News on this very topic, and they raised the issue about Orr staying on to, in fact, guide the plan of adjustment through the final phase of the confirmation hearings. But it still remains to be seen if that's going to take place. We really don't know. It's quite interesting, this quote from the today's Detroit Free Press. I just wanted to read this. It's so interesting. It said that city and state officials have been discussing whether Orr can stay in Detroit under a different title to see the city's bankruptcy case through. Then it says, this is the killer paragraph here. Orr's expertise would be needed to help implement the city's restructuring plan should it be approved as part of the ongoing bankruptcy case, unquote. And that's from the Detroit Free Press today. Orr's expertise, that's a very, very, very biased statement. Most people here have seen the conditions worsen in terms of public transportation, the conditions of the streets and the roads. There's been a lot of complaints about this new public lighting system that's taking place. Retirees being victimized by this process, city employees, failure to rejuvenate the emergency medical system, the fire services. So, they're trying to figure out a role for him beyond tomorrow.
Has his decision to rescind the plan to transfer 45,000 city-owned residential parcels to the Detroit Land Bank Authority, was that a measure to soften the hearts and to basically indicate that he's willing to play ball, he's not ready to go just yet, and this was a kind of offering, a peace offering?
Yes, he rescinded that proposal after it appeared as if it had some opposition within the Detroit City Council. Now they're saying they're going to transfer 10,000 parcels of land, vacant land, where there were houses, apartment buildings, and businesses, and that people who live in the neighborhood will have an opportunity to buy the lots that are next to their homes. This is nothing new. I mean, this plan even existed way back during the time of Coleman Young in the 80s. So it's nothing new about allowing people who have vacant property next to where they live or behind where they live to be able to purchase it at a small price in order to put the property back on the city tax rolls. But the question is, who's really interested in buying it? I mean, what is the real value of it? And can you really resell it? You know, the Land Bank Authority, in my opinion, is the biggest swindle in terms of land speculation in the modern history of the city of Detroit, because who is the person that's guiding this whole process in terms of blight removal? It's none other than Dan Gilbert, the owner of Quicken Loans, the Cleveland Cavaliers, who owns 60 buildings in downtown Detroit that was virtually given to him. He is the chairman of the Detroit Blight Removal Authority. This is clearly a conflict of interest. How can you have such a large scale capitalist, predatory banker, and venture capitalist being in control or determining whose property is blighted, whose property should be seized by the Detroit Land Bank Authority? I mean, they totally contravene city ordinances and even the Michigan State Constitution. You cannot theoretically take someone's property without going through a process. So they're acting as if they have the right to eminent domain when, in fact, they're ignoring the basic fundamental laws that govern transfer of property in a municipality. So I think this is another major controversy that's going to be brewing. And even the homes that have been taken over by the land bank, I found this out Monday at a Moratorium Now meeting, and have been sold to people in the city. They're not able to get mortgages. You know, so even though they've ostensibly have title to the property, if they can't get mortgages to pay for the property or to have it rehabilitated, then you're back to the same problem all over again. So you still have blighted property. You still have property that cannot be lived in. And so the process is not thought through. They're relying on the real estate industry, the banking industry, to finance this, and they're not interested because there's still too much risk involved in doing these type of investments in the city of Detroit when you have such widespread poverty and unemployment.
Well, as we let's summarize where the trial is and where it is expected to go. We're at the end of this week. What is on schedule? What could be expected as the trial proceeds?
Well, next week, which is going to be September the 29th, the last few days of this month, the judge is going to rule on the class action lawsuit involving the shutoff of water by the Detroit Water and Sewage Department. This lawsuit is calling for a halt to all water shutoffs for at least 6 months so a feasible water affordability plan can be put in place. That's one of the major issues in the case. Also, the FGIC, the Financial Guarantees Insurance Corporation, their case to settle with them is going to be litigated. And the judge is going to have to hold a hearing on the question of the evaluation or the actual value of the collection of art that is owned by the city. FGIC is saying that it's worth 10 times as much as is cited in the so-called grand bargain. They're saying it's worth more than $8 billion. And they could be correct, and that if that is the case, then they should be given more cash. So that's the type of logic that they're operating from. So that's going to be a hearing. And then after that, there has to be a hearing as well of additional objections and people who file motions. And this is from the side of the people, retirees, residents of the city of Detroit, who are saying that there were aspects of this agreement that were not disclosed in which people voted on or did not vote on. For example, the clawbacks in the annuities and how constitutional that is. So we still have some more litigation to be heard. And they were thinking, they were saying 2-3 weeks ago that the trial was over. But apparently it is not. And we're going into the month of October next week. And according to the official schedule, this trial was supposed to be over by October the 17th. So we have to see.
And from the city council level, when is there expected to be word about whether or stays or goes?
Hopefully there'll be word today, but we're not sure if they've reached an agreement on that or not. I haven't heard anything today. Discussions were supposed to continue this morning, so we'll know, I guess, by tomorrow. Whether or not he's going to stay on as emergency manager or he'll be given a different role in regard to perhaps being the chief legal counsel for Jones Day Corporation, which is misrepresenting the city of Detroit in this procedure. Nobody asked for them. Nobody hired them. They were appointed essentially by the emergency manager, and they are Kevin Orr's old law firm. And I've been in many federal bankruptcy hearings, and my assessment is that they are grossly incompetent, and they have very little real knowledge about what's going on in the city of Detroit, both in terms of its finances as well as the actual physical outlay and infrastructure of the city.
Well, Abayomi Ezekwe, I want to thank you, as usual, for giving us some comprehensive overview of what's going on in the courtroom and outside of it with respect to this, as I call it, a multi-pronged battle by the people of the city of Detroit to retain their sovereignty. And I want to thank you so much for keeping us abreast of what's happening.
Well, thank you so much for your continued interest. And this is, to me, as bad as it is, this is one of the most fascinating and interesting periods, not only in Detroit's history, but U.S. history overall, because this is the largest municipal bankruptcy and in the history of the country. And its outcome is going to portend much for the rest of the United States.
Thanks again. And we'll talk again as soon as there's something to report. Thanks so much for being with us.
All right. You're welcome.
Well, we'll take this break and come back and talk about when a settlement is not a settlement. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM, I'm Nutrice Lead. The City of Los Angeles last night settled a lawsuit by Marlene Pinnock, the woman you probably have seen on video being brutally beaten by California Highway Patrol Officer Daniel Andrew on the side of the freeway on July the 1st. The settlement is for $1.5 million, but as we will see, it doesn't mean that the matter is settled. Here's some background on the story filed by Bob McCall of the Associated Press.
The woman seen in this video being straddled and punched by a California Highway Patrol officer says she thought she was going to die.
When I came involved with the officer on the freeway, where he was socking me and beat me and beat me and beat me and beat me, I felt as though that he was going to kill me, that he was going to beat me to death.
Marlene Pinnock was released from the hospital last week after several weeks of treatment for head injuries following the incident on July 1st. Pinnock is suing the California Highway Patrol Commissioner and an officer in federal court for civil rights violations. The agency has said that Pinnock was endangering herself by walking on Interstate 10, and the officer was trying to restrain her. The officer in the video has not been identified, but the California Highway Patrol said he had been on the job for 1.5 years and is on desk duty pending completion of the internal investigation. The commissioner has pledged that the investigation will conclude in weeks rather than the usual months. Bob McCall, Associated Press.
Well, the settlement was announced by the Highway Patrol Commissioner last night. Apparently, after some hours of negotiation, they determined that the settlement will be $1.5 million, and Pinnock's attorney, Carrie Harper, confirmed that the settlement was, in fact, in place. But I want to bring to your attention why this case is following or has followed a typical pattern, and we've got to get into it. We just have to get into it. Well, on the one hand, one would say, well, there is a settlement, and $1.5 million is nothing to sneeze at. But I contend that this is compensation, but it isn't justice. And we see this pattern, and the reason I'm pointing this out is that it's exactly the same way that the Eric Garner case in Staten Island, the chokehold death, and the case of Michael Brown being shot to death in Ferguson, Missouri, same pattern. And it multiplies as you go across the spectrum and you see how these cases go when they are, quote, settled, unquote. The first thing is that we have two systems of law operating here. And in this settlement, everybody is agreeing to the Plan B menu of law. Not Plan A, but Plan B. Plan B is that portion of the law that basically comes under the heading of civil rights violations. And it almost always applies to people of color when grievous things happen to them at the hands of police. Somehow there will be a civil rights investigation. And we know that, as in the case of New York City and in the case of Ferguson, Missouri, the soon-to-resign attorney general has publicly said there will be an investigation, a federal investigation. And that is supposed to comfort people. That is supposed to indicate a seriousness of the matter. But it, in fact, isn't. In fact, it endorses the view of the two systems of law. When you just heard this Pinnock say that he was beating me and beating me and beating me and I thought I was going to die. Now, if she were a white woman, that would be interpreted as attempted murder. That would be interpreted as attempted murder. She had reason to believe that the attack upon her by this officer was so vicious that the intent was to kill her. But she's a black woman. And therefore, her life doesn't rise to the value of a white woman. So rather than pursue this case as a criminal matter, they instead discuss it as a civil rights matter of civil rights violations. See how it goes? This is standard operating procedure. So that in one fell swoop, right here with this settlement, all parties are agreeing to Plan B, the Plan B law, the civil rights law, because black people, like Ms. Pinnock, do not have absolute rights. They do not have natural rights. They have civil rights. And so the local investigation by the Los Angeles Police Department and by the prosecutor operates on that premise that we're not talking about a real human being here. This is a black woman. So we don't need to get all excited about criminal prosecutions. We could sit at a table and figure out, look, what would it take for you to just kind of shut up and go away? Yes, 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 bad apples, and you know, he did the wrong thing, and the only reason that they're actually sitting at the table is because some enterprising motorist on the freeway, stuck in traffic for a moment, captured the whole thing, just like the Eric Garner case, captured the whole thing on his cell phone camera. And so it was hard to make up a story, hard to deny what the people were seeing. But still, the attitude of the system, and it shapes the attitude even of her attorney, because they all confined, they're all discussing this case as the Plan B case, as a civil rights case. Nobody is discussing this case as a criminal case. That's the instruction here. So basically, for a poor black woman, the determination is, hey, $1.5 million ought to do you. And here's the sad part of that. If she were killed, she would actually be worth more. The reason she got only $1.5 million is because she wasn't killed. So even though they're all dealing with Plan B, it is still a watered-down version of Plan B because the woman had the temerity to survive the ordeal. She is actually worth more dead than alive in the way the law applies here and in the way the settlement was worked out. Now, what does this say about the attitude of criminal prosecutions when it comes to people in the law enforcement community. And we get also mixed in this factor, the racial factor. You have a white police officer and a woman of color. Automatically, these cases take different turns, and they make them take those turns. This case, from July the 1st to now, the police officer has not yet been charged, not yet arrested, not yet prosecuted. And part of the settlement is that he will, as they put it, he will be allowed to resign, unquote. Now, you tell me where in the real world, if you were to flip the script and say, well, would a black person who did, in similar circumstances, would a black police officer would be allowed to resign, still getting paid while this matter is being, quote, investigated, unquote? So when we see these things, and of course they'll make a big deal about it because a settlement has been arrived at, but that doesn't mean there's justice here. And this brings me to the other part of the issue, because it applies again I raised it before, in the Eric Garner case and in the Michael Brown case. And that is that when you have nobody taking care of business in the court to compel the system to respond differently, there's nobody in the court. There's no legal fight going on here on the criminal side. So you have the prosecution and you have the police and you have the law enforcement community able to literally transform this case from a criminal case to a civil case. And it goes all the way up to the U.S. Attorney General. Even when the U.S. Attorney General is promising investigations of these patterns and investigations of the deaths of individuals who had the great misfortune of encountering racist police officers who just shot them and in other ways dispatched them from this earth, the premise still is that they are doing so under civil rights law. Nobody is talking about sending anybody to jail or subjecting this person to arrest and certain prosecution. It isn't even on the table, because the law and the system and even the attorneys representing the victims, they all are operating on Plan B. That is to say, they all agree that the victims of these kinds of violence are really not real people. They're second-class citizens. They are beneficiaries of rights given or allowed them through legislative action. They don't actually have natural rights. So they're not to be represented, they're not to be litigated for as real human beings. We could always negotiate around their lives because they're really not real people. Now, when the case is said to be attracting federal intervention or federal attention, and people think that this is a great idea, the federal government is also admitting and also endorsing and also continuing this bad practice of relieving the state of its burden. And the state has an obligation and a duty to affirm the rights of victims of crime, including victims of police criminality. That's the state's job. So I go crazy when I hear people, like in New York City, calling for a federal investigation. No, you don't want a federal investigation. You also want the local, you want the local authorities, the city council, and the local authorities that have direct jurisdiction over the operations of the police department to step up. You want them to play their role because they have a direct responsibility for the operation of the police department. And the state legislature has a direct role, and the governor has a direct role. So when these people come together, and for the purpose of political expediency, more than anything else, they all agree. You know what we're going to do? We'll say, well, we're handing this. This is such a serious matter that we will hand it over to the feds. And behind closed doors, they're cracking up. They're laughing because they've just pulled the wool over everybody's eyes. The federal government should come into a case when the state government has failed or is failing to do its job. But in this case, the state isn't doing the job. It never even started the job. And they agree, we'll take that off the table. We'll give people the impression that something is happening, when in fact, the federal government, in insisting that it will, you know, basically win back the trust of the people and all of that, because it's democratic officials are on the line, and this is election time, and nobody is interested in ruffling any feathers within the party. So they will all agree that we'll just talk about, you know, we'll do an investigation, fine, great, on civil rights violations, of course. No criminal matters. This man who has beaten this woman up, this police officer, has not yet seen the inside of a jail cell. He has not yet been arrested. He has suffered no real consequence legally for his heinous act, which in regular language is tantamount to attempted murder. The woman said, I thought he was going to kill me. He kept punching me and punching me and punching me. And her words fit the video. What she said was exactly what we saw. He straddled her and kept pummeling her. And then another officer comes, and even though he can see plainly that she has been attacked by the first police officer, assists the police officer in handcuffing her without wanting to know, well, are you half dead? Is she alive? Is she even breathing? So this is what we need to understand of these kinds of cases. And we see the need here, and I'm not in any way trying to impugn the reputation or professional prowess of the attorney who handled this case on behalf of Marlene Pinnock. She is taking care of the civil side of the case, and we know we commented that about that in the case of Eric Garner and in the case of Michael Brown. The attorneys, the Sharpton-appointed attorneys, are in for the payout. But nobody is paying attention to what the real important deal is here, which is to pursue justice. And you don't pursue justice when you settle. You don't pursue justice sitting at a table saying, well, look, she wasn't really killed, but she did get beaten up a bit. So I think that's $1.5 million. Yeah, we'll take that. And then that's the end of the case. And then you come back to the community and you tell people that you have prevailed. No, you haven't. You haven't prevailed. You got money. I'm all for that. Get as much money as you can as compensation. But let's tackle what is at issue here. And the issue is the double standard in the application of the law, the way that police officers especially white police officers, implicated in the deaths and in the brutality against people of color, they always find an exit. And here we are. From July 1st to September the 25th, this police officer has not yet been in any way seriously embraced by the prosecutorial system. And he was being paid while they did nothing. And he is going to be allowed to resign. So there isn't really too much of damage that he has sustained, other than the inconvenience of having to find a new job. It is, his life will go on. He'll be able to live, even as a person who should be up on charges for attempted murder, at the very least. You see how it works? Two systems of justice, and everybody's agreeing to play by the same rules. And this is why I invoke the name Alton Maddox. This would never have happened with an Alton Maddox in this situation. Because he understands that the justice comes when you engage the system and you fight the system where they least expect it. And you can't do that by sitting at the table with the folks negotiating a settlement. Because in a very real way, Marlene Pinnock is not an individual case. Marlene Pinnock is all black people, all Latino people, all people, period, who should never, ever have to experience anything like that at the hands of police who are paid with the tax dollars of the public. Never. It should never happen. And if it should happen, it ought to be certain. This shouldn't be iffy. It shouldn't be a question mark. It ought to be certain that prosecution will be swift. But America is prone to accept all of that flimflam, all of that propaganda, that this represents progress. And I'm sure that at some point we'll see a news conference, the NAACP and all the local folks are going to come together and announce victory, that victory has been won, and the will of the people has been heard, and the situation here has been vindicated, and all of that. They're not paying attention to the justice element of it, and they're not because nobody's paying attention to it, period. And this is where we are. Everybody essentially agreeing that black people really don't have very many rights at all that are absolute or that even derive from their own humanity. It is not to be assumed that they have natural rights. At the very best, in every case that we have seen, in every single case that I have covered, and I've been covering these kinds of cases for close to 40 years, it is always about their civil rights. Were their civil rights violated? Yes, they're dead in the street, or with, like Eleanor Bumpers, in her home with a huge hole in her chest, because supposedly her rent wasn't paid on time, and a SWAT team breaks down the door, enters her very tiny rent-stabilized home, and blasts her to smithereens. And turns out they were all wrong. She wasn't late in her rent. The Department of Social Services did not process her paperwork in time. And since when is a SWAT team the way that you conduct an eviction. And to this day, nobody has paid a price. Amadou Diallo, nobody has paid a price. In Miami 3 years ago, a young man leaving a concert, driving through a huge crowd, trying to avoid people, 116 bullets. 3 years ago, not one single police officer has even been charged with the crime, let alone prosecuted and convicted. So, when is a settlement not a settlement in this kind of a case? And we will be tempted to accept, well, some modicum of justice has been achieved here. And I'm saying to you, don't fall for it. If anything, this case reinforces two awful things. One is that black people still have no rights, that the white man need respect. You know, the same Dred Scott decision still applies. And number two is that when you have these kinds of cases cropping up, invariably all parties concerned agree to implement Plan B, including the people who ought to be litigating in behalf of the victim. That is a whole other discussion that the community needs to have with itself. But that, in fact, is the reality. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I hope that this program in some way opened our ears and eyes to what's happening in the real world. You can write me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Stay tuned. Keep it right here. Occupied Territory America with Mike Fader is next. And really, I want you to get excited about promoting PRN and your favorite program, of course, on PRN. We are edging toward 390,000 downloads, and that's quite impressive. But we need to make this a little bit a greater effort to make this program grow. And so I'm counting on you to be ambassadors for the program and to help us along. Tell your friends, people in your sphere of influence, that this station and Lead Stories are your musts for the week. You've got to listen or else you'll be deprived. And, of course, we return to each other tomorrow when it will be Free Your Mind Friday. If this news is true about Eric Holder resigning, I'm sure we have a lot to talk about tomorrow. Until then, a great pleasure and an even greater privilege to be in your esteemed company. Bye-bye.